Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Russell, Dorothy Gundy, and Brian Lynn. Later, John Russell and Phil Dierking will bring us this week's education report. But first, here are John Russell and Dorothy Gundy.
Recent withdrawals from the International Criminal Court have raised questions about the court's future. Russia announced its withdrawal in the middle of November. Earlier, three African nations said they planned to leave. Observers expect difficult times for the court in the weeks to come. More nations will likely be leaving. Alex Whiting is a law professor at Harvard University in Massachusetts. He once supervised investigations and legal action against suspects for the International Criminal Court. He expects the court to survive. I think there will be some difficulties, but that the court is not going to collapse, Whiting told VOA. He said one reason is the court's special power to bring action against the world's worst kinds of crimes.
The International Criminal Court was founded in 2002. It is based in the Netherlands. It is considered the court of last resort, the place where criminal charges are brought after all other legal efforts have failed. Its aim is to bring to justice people responsible for horrible crimes when their own countries are unwilling or unable to take action. The court investigates and tries cases of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. The most important criminal case yet is against Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. He is accused of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. He remains in office. The Sudanese leader has visited other countries in violation of an international ban on his travel. He was able to avoid arrest during visits to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa. The court is currently trying Laurent Gbagbo, the former president of the Ivory Coast. He faces charges related to thousands of murders and rapes while he was in power. Among those jailed by the court was former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. He was found guilty of war crimes.
In another case, the court ruled against Ahmed al-Faqih al-Mahdi, an Islamist rebel, for his part in the 2012 violence in Mali. He admitted guilt to destroying Muslim holy places in the historic city of Timbuktu. Daryl Robinson is an expert on international law at Queen's University Law School in Kingston, Canada. He said the court has done a lot in its short 14-year history. But there are many serious problems in the world, Robinson said. As a result, the court faces demands to do more. On one hand, the International Criminal Court has been active in far more situations than I think anyone would have predicted in its short history, Robinson said. But on the other hand, there are so many situations in the world that are clamoring for attention.
Russia, like the United States, has not accepted the treaty setting up the court's right to exercise power. Therefore, neither country falls under its authority. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced his country's withdrawal from the court earlier this month. His announcement came after the court's chief prosecutor said that Russia's takeover of Crimea amounted to an ongoing state of occupation. There have also been calls for the court to investigate suspected war crimes by Russian forces protecting the government in Syria. Russia's foreign ministry said the court is not living up to its responsibility to be even-handed.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has said he might follow Russia out of the International Criminal Court. His comment came after the court warned Duterte over reports of the killing of thousands of people as part of his war on illegal drugs. Before Russia announced its withdrawal, three African countries, Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia, announced plans to withdraw from the court. Officials from the three countries said the court unfairly targets African leaders. All those convicted by the court have been Africans. South Africa says it was pressured to arrest and surrender the Sudanese president to the court when he visited the country last year. Whiting of Harvard University said it is regrettable a large percentage of the court's cases relate to African countries. But he said court officials argue that they are targeting the world's most serious cases of government-led abuse.
The court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, said she is disappointed at any act that may undermine the court's authority to hold people responsible for horrible crimes. She called for more discussions with leaders of Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia. Bensouda also said the court would put more importance on crimes against children. It is unforgivable that children are assaulted, violated, murdered, she said. Such crimes should trouble all good people, she said. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm John Russell.
Thank you. Thailand's parliament has officially invited Crown Prince Wachira Lunkon to become the country's next king. The parliament acted after Thailand's cabinet named the prince to be the new king. The president of the National Assembly, Pornpet Wichicholachai, officially nominated the prince. He urged legislators to give their blessings to the new king. Parliament members then stood up and replied, "Long live the king." Thailand's king, Bhumibol Adulyadet, died last month at the age of 88. He was the world's longest-serving monarch and served as king for 70 years. The process for choosing a new king is described in a 1924 Thai law. The law gives the king power to choose who should succeed him. In 1972, Bhumibol chose Wachira Lunkon, his second child and only son, to be his successor. The last step is for the prince to meet with leaders of the National Assembly before being formally named king. Government officials said that meeting is expected to happen soon. The 64-year-old prince spends much of his time outside Thailand. He is often in Germany, where he owns property. The prince has yet to gain the same respect in Thailand as his father. King Bhumibol was greatly beloved across Thailand, a mainly Buddhist country. He was known as a humble leader who directed many social and economic development projects. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha said shortly after Bhumibol's death, the prince told him he did not want to immediately become king. He said he needed more time to mourn his father. The government declared a full year of mourning for all public offices after the king's death. Many Thais have dressed in black or white since then to honor him. The king's remains have been on display at the Grand Palace in Bangkok so Thai people can pay their respects. His body will be cremated in a special ceremony likely to take place a year or more after his death. The official coronation of Wachira Lunkon will happen after the cremation. I'm Brian Lin.
President-elect Donald Trump says people who burn the American flag should be punished. He suggested that punishment could be up to a year in prison or a loss of citizenship. But it will not be easy for Trump to carry out his proposal. In 1989, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that flag burning is protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech. Changing a Supreme Court decision requires either amending the amendment or a new opinion by the High Court. Neither is easy to get done. The Supreme Court case involved a man named Gregory Lee Johnson. He was arrested In 1984, for burning an American flag at the Republican Party's National Convention in Texas. Johnson said he set the flag on fire to protest the nomination of Ronald Reagan for a second term as U.S. president. A lower court had ruled against Johnson, but the high court overturned the decision. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that a lot of Americans are offended by the burning of the American flag. But he noted that in the Texas case, Johnson burned the flag as an act of protest. As an act of protest, he said, flag burning is protected under free speech. The hard fact is that sometimes we must make decisions we do not like. Kennedy wrote, "We make them because they are right, right in the sense that the law and the Constitution, as we see them, compel the result." Four Supreme Court justices agreed with Kennedy. Four others disagreed. Writing for the minority judges, Justice William Rehnquist noted that burning a flag is not really free speech. He said it is more like a person grunting, making sounds like an animal. Trump has not said why he is raising the flag burning issue now. But his comments on Twitter came after a group of U.S. military veterans protested at a small Massachusetts college last weekend. The veterans objected to the removal of an American flag at Hampshire College, a private school in the town of Amherst. The removal came after some students lowered the flag to half staff on November 9th. That was the day after the U.S. presidential election, of which Trump has been declared the winner. Flags are flown at half staff to recognize deaths of important people or to recognize sad events. Some Hampshire College students and teachers said they are fearful of what will happen under Trump's presidency. The flag continued to be flown at half staff until November 10th, when it was burned. The college says it does not know who burned the flag. A new flag was ordered flown at half staff. But later, college president Jonathan Lash ordered the flag removed, saying some had seen it flying at half staff as a comment on the presidential election. It was not, Lash said. He said it was part of an effort by the college to deal with divisions over the flag among members of the college community. "We've heard from members of our campus community that, for them and for many in our country, the flag is a powerful symbol of fear they've felt all their lives, because they grew up in marginalized communities, never feeling safe," Lash said. For others, the flag is a symbol of their highest aspirations for the country. On CNN Television Tuesday, Trump spokesman Jason Miller said that the country's next president believes flag burning should be illegal. The president-elect is a very strong supporter of the First Amendment, but there's a big difference between that and burning the American flag, Miller said.
Last week, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump nominated Betsy DeVos to be the Secretary of Education in his administration. DeVos is an education activist. She supports school choice, a term for policies that let students and their families choose between attending private or public schools. DeVos has been a leading supporter of charter schools. So, what are charter schools? How are they different from traditional public schools in the United States? In today's education report, we explore the charter school movement.
The American state of Minnesota passed the country's first charter school law in the early 1990s. Since then, charter schools have spread from coast to coast. There are currently more than 6,700 charter schools, educating nearly 3 million students nationwide. Those numbers come from the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, a nonprofit organization. Charter schools are a kind of public school that receives a special charter, or written rules, from a state government. A charter is a document, or series of documents, that gives rights to a person or group of individuals. Charter schools cannot require students to pay tuition for their education. The schools also cannot set admissions requirements. If too many young people ask to be admitted, the school must choose its students through a lottery system. Charter schools are different from public schools in many ways. They often have flexibility in the kinds of classes and programs that they can offer. They often do not have to follow the rules public schools do. John Vallant is an education expert at the Brookings Institution, a public policy group. He says the charter school movement grew out of unhappiness with public schools. Over time, different groups began supporting the charter cause. Civil rights groups wanted schools that broke down barriers based on race or wealth. Parents wanted greater ability to choose where their children went to school. Some Americans said that competition between schools could improve the quality of education. The main idea was that increased flexibility in an education program would let charter schools better serve their students.
Not all Americans like charter schools. For over 20 years, critics have argued that charter schools take money away from public schools and may not serve students with special needs. Some civil rights groups have opposed charter schools. The NAACP and Black Lives Matter movement, for example, have released statements criticizing charter schools. They say that charter schools have exacerbated segregation, increasing racial barriers. The groups have also criticized the use of suspension as a punishment in charter schools. They point to studies that suggest that charter schools are more likely to suspend minority students. Some labor and union organizers disagree about whether charter schools are actually public schools. The National Labor Relations Board, for example, recently ruled in two cases that teachers at charter schools operate under rules that govern private sector employees. Traditionally, public school teachers are subject to laws for public employees.
In the United States, tests are often used to measure educational success. When opponents and supporters of charter schools talk about a school's performance, they are often talking about state test results. Whether current state tests are the best way to measure success is a subject of debate. Vallant at Brookings explains what the evidence shows about state tests and charter schools.
The best evidence we have now is that if you look across the country, kids in charter schools perform similarly on state tests to kids who are in similar schools. So it doesn't look like there are very large effects across the board on test scores.
Vallant goes on to explain that charter schools are not all the same. Some charter schools do a better job than others do.
Having said that, the effects on test scores are more positive in urban areas, which is where there's a lot of energy behind charter schools. So that's where you do tend to see charters outperforming some of the local traditional public schools on state tests.
Another point, Vallant adds, is that one of the hopes of charter school founders was to desegregate American schools. This reality was one that the charter school movement hoped, but has not been able to change. Another hope of the founders is that charter schools would increase competition with public schools. The idea was that competition would lead all schools to improve. To date, there is no proof that the competition has improved public school quality. That evidence just isn't there, Vallant says.
Michael Hansen is an education expert at the Brookings Institution. He says he thinks the debates over charter schools show that some Americans are suspicious of the idea of public money going to private interests. The idea that charter schools have ties to private organizations, such as religious groups, is one common misconception. Vallant, also at Brookings, adds that the charter movement has appealed to Americans with different beliefs. This appeal, which has not been true of other education reform ideas, helps to explain some of the growth of charter schools. Charter schools have not unified both political parties, Vallant explains, but these schools have found enough support in the country's two leading parties. I think that support, he adds, has been important in the sustained development of what is a pretty fundamental restructuring of the way that schools are governed. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.